Welcome to the Whose Body Is It podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Malbin. For those who don't know me, I'm a birth worker, a life coach, hypnotist, and a former liberal feminist turned radical truth teller. On this podcast, I expose the forces at play attempting to control our minds and bodies, such as transgender ideology, pornography, prostitution, and so much more. Together, we'll untangle patriarchal lies as you listen to jaw-dropping interviews with women from around the world. Warning, while listening to this podcast, you might find yourself triggered or perhaps notice where you've been biting your tongue on the issues that matter most to you. In my coaching and hypnosis, I help women and men stop getting triggered by every single thing, cultivate resilience, stop unwanted behaviors, and increase self-confidence. You can book your first session at whosebodyisit.com, and you can find that link in the episode show notes. And I just want to say that it's because of your endless support that I'm able to interview amazing women, get their stories out, and produce regular episodes for you. So with that being said, please like, comment, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. And if you're listening in, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And also consider making a financial contribution via the link in my show notes. You can also visit my activist sticker shop. My pro-woman stickers have the power to intercept transhumanist programming. So take a photo of your stickers out in the wild and tag me on Instagram at Whose Body Is It. Without further ado, let's get into this week's story. When Julia Beck was coming out, first by calling herself bisexual and eventually embracing herself as a lesbian, most of the other women around her were calling themselves gender fluid or queer, anything but what they plainly were, which was lesbian. She encountered the Scum Manifesto, her first radical text, and began to question everything she understood about the order of men and women in society. She began working with the Women's Liberation Radio News and Women's Liberation Front as her politics became unapologetically lesbian and female-centered. It was also around this time that she was elected to Baltimore's LGBT Commission, where she intended to use her seat to defend women's sex-based rights. On this commission, she was smeared by a man who ran the Baltimore Trans Advocacy Group. She was voted off the commission, and he was voted on to replace her. The jury had spoken, and they decided that a man in a stuffed bra could woman better than an actual woman. Since then, Julia has continued to fearlessly advocate for women's rights. Join us in this conversation as we ask provocative questions about sexual politics for women. Would you just start off by talking a little bit about where you were maybe before the trans madness, or maybe even sharing your peaking story?
There are so many moments, you know, you look back and you see so many moments along the way where it was one peak after the other. And each time you think it's the last. And then you just see something else that blows your mind even more. I guess the best place to start would be what I read that opened my mind to thinking in a different way. It was the Scum Manifesto by Valerie Solanas. And wow, it shocked me. I never knew that women could write this way. I studied English. I studied how to teach English. And so I read a lot of novels, a lot of fiction, a lot of classics, as they are called. And mostly are written by men. You know, the canon is very male. And so when I got a hold of this Scum Manifesto by Valerie Solanas, I was really just blown away. And I fell in love with the kind of power that she used in her words. We know more about the kind of person that she was and the kinds of things that she was experiencing. You could say that she had a little bit of trouble in the head to be putting it in a euphemistic way. But I don't think that takes away anything from the force and the power behind her ideas. So that was the first really radical text that I read. I was given that text by two lesbians in Baltimore, Maryland. And we were just friends. We would hang out. They would have parties, dinners at their place. The interesting thing was that it was only women who came over, but almost none of the women called themselves lesbians. And so I was coming out thinking about maybe calling myself a lesbian. I first started with bisexual and then eased into it. But looking back now, I think, wow, I was given this wonderful text in the company of women who were participating in our own erasure. That's a little bit twisted, but I am very grateful for them anyway. It was a fantastic company to be in. And I guess that's where it all started.
Wow. So, okay. So what were they calling themselves then if they weren't calling themselves lesbian?
It would be non-binary. That was a really popular one. There were a few gender fluids. That's really fallen out of style, I notice. No one really is gender fluid these days.
That's but, a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Non-binary is popular. I think that was the main one. There was a non-man. There was a trans man that I remember. I don't remember so much specifics, because at the same time, it wasn't so important. There was not such a heavy meaning placed onto these words in the same way that I think is placed on them today, at least on online. So I'm really not sure what exactly the words were, but no, unfortunately, lesbian was not one of them.
And what year is this? Like,
this would be 2015, 2016. Around 2017, I had a more radical group of friends, and it would be the same kind of thing: dinners, meetups, let's get together and let's talk about how to burn it all down. But we were all lesbians, and we all called ourselves some kind of feminist, mostly radical feminist. And that was really a wonderful blossoming of friends and community. And we organized things together. We did actions together. We vandalized things together, and that was amazing and fantastic. And that really gave me a lot of strength. It made me think that I could do something more meaningful than just, you know, going out at 3 a.m. with a marker.
So what was that more meaningful thing? What do you mean? Like,
well, I had started to volunteer with a feminist podcast called Women's Liberation Radio News. They're still going strong after how many years? It's incredible. Props to WLRN. I was working with them and doing interviews as similar as you're doing now. And I think my first interview was with Julie Bindel, and my microphone wasn't working, and I was so ashamed. So I was doing that, and I was working with Wolf, Women's Liberation Front, also, you know, writing a little bit of testimony here and there, reviewing some bills and things like that. But it was all behind the scenes. I wanted to have a more impactful thing that I could be doing. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity. The Baltimore mayor at that time wanted to set up a commission. It would be for LGBTQ people, and the people on that commission would be helping to identify issues or problems to solve within the city for this community. And so I thought, why not? I joined the commission, and it broke into committees. It's so bureaucratic. But I was on the law and policy committee. And so the people on my group were directly reviewing laws and policies, for example, from the police department. That didn't go so well in the end, because they ousted me because I was transphobic. There was this guy who came in. He, at the time, was the president of the Baltimore Transgender Alliance, and he accused me of transphobia, even though he wasn't part of the whole thing. Suddenly he's there at one of our meetings and shaking my hand, and I'm thinking, this is the time that I'm going now. Like, and that's exactly what happened. He since has detransitioned, which is interesting.
Oh, wow.
I wrote about this for 4W Pub. You can read about it there. I think also Redux wrote an article about this too. This guy stuffed his bra for a few years, got me kicked out of the commission, took my place, and now he's calling himself a man again. So, oh.
Wow. Okay. When's your handwritten apology coming?
Yeah, for real. No, I think he's really far up his own ass when it comes to like narcissism and that whole thing. This is the deal with a lot of these guys, and he's a perfect example.
Wow. Wow. So was it, God, that's wild. So he replaced, so not only did he get you kicked out, but he replaced you, which again, wow, that's just the whole narrative that, yeah, these men can be better women than women can be.
Yeah,
women.
Really.
Isn't that interesting? So how did I'm just curious about like that point. I mean, they're all these, the kicking out stories, like, are all generally the same. I'm always fascinated by the sequence of events. Like, did you get a warning? Were you formally excused face to face or via email? Were there complaints that you were violent and triggering? Because I've had my own experiences being kicked out of various spaces, and they all seem to follow a similar kind of inching towards my fate.
Yeah. There was a process to it. I think it all started with one of these proposed policies from the Baltimore Police Department. The police had written up a kind of policy that would be inclusive. So, for example, a police officer could perform a strip search on someone according to their gender identity. So a male officer could not strip search a female person on the street. But in this policy proposal, if the officer identified as female, then he could strip search a female person, and vice versa, you know. And I said, maybe that's not a good idea. There were some other policies that included gender identity in place of sex as a characteristic, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote a feedback. I shared it with the people on my committee, and I said, if anyone has, you know, comments on this, please let me know. Otherwise, I'll send it to the police department in a week. And no one got back to me. So I thought, okay, fuck it. I'll just send it along. I did. And then I think it was after that, at our next meeting, it's all really a bit fuzzy because I try to put it out of my head.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
One thing led to another, and there was a meeting called to discuss my fitness as one of the chairs of this committee. I had been elected to be one of two chairs of the committee, which was really cool. And so then an emergency meeting was called to discuss my fitness, my ability to actually be a leader in this group. And so when I get there, there's this guy with a really long ponytail and a stuffed bra. And there's two other guys, and they discuss with me my transphobia, and they challenge me about my professionalism, things like this. And then there's a motion to put it to a vote. So it was just me and three of these guys, and one of them proposes to the whole group to have a vote. And the vote would be whether or not I should be removed. And so at a following meeting, everyone on the commission is there. And there were two women from Wolf who came with me. One was a very good friend, also an out lesbian, radical feminist. The other was also a good friend, a radical feminist. And then the table was full of not only people from my committee, but people who identified as trans. There were two women who had undergone hysterectomies. I think there was one man in addition to the guy who got me kicked out eventually. They just went around the table and talked about how everything I did was transphobic. And at the end, like I didn't know how to defend myself. That was the very first moment where I was put on the spot to say biology is real. It was really crazy. And I didn't know what my arguments should have been. Now that I think back on that time, I really wish I could have just laughed in everybody's faces and done their job for them and walk out. Or I don't know. Now there's so many better arguments because women have been at this for decades. And every day I'm learning something new that a woman has said 5 years ago.
Mm.
But anyway, long story short, they put it to a vote. The vote is to kick me out. So I'm cut out of the email list. I don't have access to those things anymore. And then the question was, do I still want to attend the meetings, even though I'm not welcome there? So I didn't want to do that.
Which
I didn't want to put myself...
It? Yeah, are you dangerous and transphobic, or are you like a useful contributor to the mission? I mean, which one is it?
I don't know. But at the end of the day, I'm glad actually to be out of that situation. It was not healthy at all. Yeah.
That's really wild. I mean, to be just like surrounded, like in a witch hunt, like in a witch trial, men impersonating women, telling you that you're transphobic for not pretending that they're women. I mean, it's totally nuts. I mean, gosh, it's yeah. Totally nuts. Wow. Wow.
One of the craziest things that happened at that evening was one of these women who had undergone a complete hysterectomy, bilateral mastectomy, the whole nine yards. I don't think she had a phalloplasty, but that's not my business anyway. She shared that her vulva is male. It's a man. It's masculine. She used these words. She's like, I'm a man. I'm male. My vulva is a man. It's male. Something like this. And I just thought, where am I? Did I go through the looking glass? This cannot be real. Yeah. And it really, to see this woman defending her ideology as if she would be defending herself was at the same time shocking and also scary. Like, this is how far people can go to defend some kind of belief that they have united with their sense of self so deeply that any challenge to it is a challenge to them as a person. It's nuts. And I hope that, I don't know, I hope that people like this can really wake up slowly but surely. It's a rude awakening, I know, but gotta wake up, sister.
Gosh, I wonder what happened to her. Oh my gosh.
I don't know. I hope she's okay. I hope she's better now and healthy. But we know what happens to these people who take like synthetic hormones and shit like that. The health just deteriorates rapidly. And I don't wish that for any woman.
Yeah.
Men, okay, do what you want. But women, please stop.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Men shouldn't also have their health to deteriorate. But I really don't care about men. They're the ones that got us here in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, all the major corporatists are men. I mean, there's no female transhumanist corporatists.
I mean, Martine Rothblatt is the first female, what, rich CEO or something like this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The richest CEO in the world or man.
Yeah.
So do you consider yourself a, you know, you're not a lesbian separatist, right? You're not like living on woman's land or how do you make that, you know, distinction when you mentioned like burning it all down? I mean, I assume you're talking about the patriarchy, not the city of Baltimore.
No.
would you talk a little bit about like your political affiliations or beliefs and how they intersect with you know, a rad fem analysis.
I love the idea of separatism. Love it. Love, love, love it. I wish for all women to try to practice this in any way that they can. The concept of separatism is very easy. It's a simple idea and easy to understand. Women just live with each other. No men around. Men are not even a concept to be considered. That means women being in communities, depending on other women, and ultimately being self-sustaining in every way, whether that's making their own food, making their own textiles, teaching each other, raising each other's children, building their own houses, things like this. I love this idea. In reality, though, it's very difficult. I talk about this a lot with my friends, and whenever we have a discussion group here, or even when we're at like a radical feminist camp, the topic always comes up. Oh, wow, I love to be in the company of you women. Oh, wow, the energy feels so much better. You know, things like this. Oh, wow, I feel free. I feel comfortable in my body now, knowing that no one's looking at me in the way that I usually get looked at on the street or in my home from my fathers and brothers. But in practice, it's difficult because the wider world around us is patriarchal, and the systems that we depend on are patriarchal. It's very difficult for women to be self-sufficient in a patriarchal world. It's possible, but it's difficult. And I think lesbians are a prime example of this. Lesbians are women who are loving women. We're sexually oriented towards women. We get aroused and we feel sensuality with and among other women. That is a little bit difficult if two lesbians want to, for example, adopt children. It's complicated, I guess, in every country. Now, not so much as in the last years, I'm sure, but still there are complications. And we have to think about the things that women have gained in just the last 100 years. My grandmother couldn't open her own bank account. Think about how difficult it must have been for lesbians to be independent. So I like the idea of separatism, but it's difficult. And I think lesbians are trying really hard on many levels. Of course, heterosexual women are also trying this, and bisexual women too. But I think when we talk about lesbians, it's a very specific separatism on the basis of sex as an act, not just as a biological fact, but sex as an act. This is the kind of separatism that I find really revolutionary because it's the basis of our oppressed state as women. So if we can get the men out of our heads, we can get them out of our beds. That's, you know, a few steps toward female liberation from male supremacy.
What's a heterosexual woman to do in this predicament? You know, it's hard. You know, I talk about this with my rad femme heterosexual, you know, friends all the time, you know, that, you know, and I'm not married. I've never been married, you know, but some of my closest and dearest friends have been in, you know, some of them close to 20 year relationships with men, and I learn from them constantly about, you know, navigating these issues. You know, how do you live in polarity? How do you live with, you know, acknowledging biological difference and also wanting, you know, support and love and a mother-centered home? And I've been able to bridge, you know, some of the gaps in my learning and understanding of matriarchal societies. And that has been a great comfort to me to see how, wow, men and women actually did live in harmony. And some of these societies are still, you know, modern matriarchal society. I mean, it's not that they're untouched by patriarchy, but, you know, what are the ways where, what were the times or the places, you know, what were the circumstances that allowed for a society without rape? I mean, when I learned about this from the Modern Matriarchal Studies teacher, Heide Abendroth, I always slip it. Thank
you.
Thankfully, you speak German. Heide. You know, when we got to the segment of the course where she, you know, we were like, was there rape? And she's like, no. And we're like, you're lying. You couldn't possibly be telling the truth. This is a fantastical place. What is this place where, you know, there isn't rape? Yeah. And she explained why. And it's, you know, because the result would be isolation and death. I mean, no one would chance. The worst thing that could happen in a matriarchal society is isolation. Because isolation meant death. And so it wasn't a thing. And anyway, so I think, you know, my listeners are definitely, you know, I would say predominantly heterosexual women, mothers, who are like, how do I hold both? Like, how do I, you know, How can I practice a woman-loving living, or kind of a parts of the separatist philosophy, but like still be like in love with this man and have this man be the father of my children, and in in the current socio kind of political circumstances that we find ourselves in. So
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's there's so many questions, right? We always have so many questions. How does it work? But how can I make this work? How can I bring the concept into reality? And I'm sorry to say, I don't have all the answers. But so many women who came before us have really thought about all of this stuff already. I mean, come on, years, decades of writings just on these topics alone. It's amazing what the women before us have gone through. And the first thing I would recommend is to try not to reinvent the wheel. There's a woman called Beck Wonders, and she works a lot about archiving feminist texts, notes from feminist meetings even. And she made a really good point. She says the history of women's movements is systematically, purposefully erased. It's not recorded. And this is making us reinvent the wheel every 50 or so years. It's because we present a threat to the dominant system. Of course, the system is going to try to consolidate power in any way that it can. So our records are not republished. So that's the first thing I want to say. Please seek out as much feminist literature as you possibly can on these topics, heterosexuality, the nuclear family, things like this. One good way that I can recommend as a baby step into practicing separatism is to listen to female artists. I found it really hard, actually, as I was leaving university and living on my own and trying to work out my own place in the world. I listened to a lot of male artists, male bands, male vocalists, basically. And when I tried to start listening to female women's music, all I could find was like Beyonce, Britney Spears, Shakira. I mean, these are very talented women, and they're very entertaining women, but they're very sexualized women. And so I say, try to find women's music. That's a good step. That's a really good step to take for any woman, whether or not she's lesbian, heterosexual, whatever. But you bring up a really interesting topic about what heterosexual women can do, the kind of situation that they're in when they want to try to be in a more feminist, I don't want to say lifestyle, but a practice. They want to put feminist theory into practice, but they love a man. Well, it's also related to isolation. When a woman is married to a man, she usually lives in his house. Of course, they can buy a house together, but they usually live just in a closed unit. There's not much of an intergenerational family anymore. That's not the modern nuclear family. It's a wife, a husband, 2.5 kids, and a dog, right? And a picket fence and this kind of thing. So women are, from the start, isolated from other women in this organization of what a family means. I think something really, really radical would be for women to live in women's houses, like the Muso do, I think, in China. The women all live in their own house and the men come visit. And I think the children also live with the women, but it's the men who are always transitory, going and coming. If we could replicate that in some way, that would be fantastic. But I also find the nuclear family to be the location of so much violence against women. I was just talking about sexuality with some friends this past weekend. And it was a very interesting conversation. What is sex, actually? What does it mean when something changes from sensual touch into sexual excitement? And one of the women who I was in this conversation asked, well, how many times does a heterosexual woman have to have sex every week or every month? Is it 3 times a week, 2 times a week, once a week, every week? I don't have that much sex. When I have sex, it's a long time, but it's not to that,
the frequency,
to that bone chilling frequency, really. I will admit I have been with men in the past and it was like that. It was constant and I couldn't say no, really. And if I did say no, he would find a way to turn my no into a maybe and then turn the maybe into an all right. And so this would be a question that I would like to pose to my heterosexual sisters. Do you really want to be engaging with your man or with men in general in this frequency? What happens when you try to reduce the frequency? Do you feel comfortable to maybe say no? Is there tension? Does it create tension in the relationship when you try to reduce this frequency, or are you found compromising in what you do or how you perform? These are the kinds of questions that I would love for women to ask themselves, and also lesbians are included in this. We are all programmed to have some kind of patriarchal script running. And once we start to ask these questions and be honest with ourselves, then we start to deprogram.
Wow. That is a really powerful question.
That is, you don't have to answer.
Oh gosh. Yeah. No, please. No, not today. No, but I mean, you do. Yeah. You do pose a very, very powerful question. You know, I think also your point about domestic abuse, you know, happening, you know, being enabled by the isolation, you know, makes total sense. I mean,
I'm wondering also, I mean, in some cultures, it's pretty common to have a multi-generational household, right? I mean, I come from a culture where it's not so common. I come from the United States and, you know, the American dream is to be in the suburbs, isolated in the nuclear family. But of course, there are cultures around the world and over time that were patriarchal, but they also had multi-generational households, mm-hmm. and yet still there was domestic violence occurring. So I think we need to bring these two concepts together, not just to have multi-generational household, but to have it matrifocal, you know, mm-hmm. where the old woman has the say, she makes all the decisions and you look up to her. I think that's an important part that's missing.
Mm-hmm. And not because she wants to exert dominance and control, but because no. that just is the best outcome for everyone in the family. It's just,
it always is.
No, it's so true. You know, one thing that I'm sure you've come across too that I find particularly frustrating is, well, you know, it's amazing that people, you know, across the aisle are like working together to fight the gender identity industry. I'm all for that. I love conservative women. I've worked with conservative women, religious Christians, Orthodox Jews. You know, I'm like, you know, this is not a kind of a calling out of any one, you know, group necessarily. But I will say that a point of frustration for me is the talking point that, you know, around like this, the whole trans agenda, trying to destroy the nuclear family, you know, like putting the nuclear family on a pedestal, romanticizing the nuclear family parenthood in isolation. I think what they're saying is, you know, we could talk about the loss of parental rights and the normalization yeah. of third party reproduction. And, you know, all those points are relevant and important, but yeah, I just can't get behind this, like, they're just trying to destroy the nuclear family. I'm like, yeah, let's destroy it. Like, let's go back to the Klan. let's get it over with. But yeah, there's that conflation of this agenda, you know, being kind of maybe gripping a bit tightly to something that isn't serving women.
Yeah. I also see a kind of backlash in TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, but some of the women who I follow on social media are, and they're reporting that there's a trend now with younger women to look like a 1950s housewife. It's called trad wife.
Yes.
What the fuck is this? It's like the backlash to liberal. It's the conservative backlash to the
Yes.
liberal wave that we've seen.
Yeah.
It's just
Yeah.
swinging the opposite way, though.
Yeah, I've seen this more in the homeschooling, homesteading, like in its particular flavor, not as like tacky and overtly misogynistic, but undertones of misogyny, like more women should just admit that they just want to like bake bread, and like baking bread is the most fulfilling thing that they could do. And I'm like, okay, that's amazing. Like if you love homemaking and you are like a baker, I mean that is an artistry. Like that, I'm not seeing myself as a podcaster and some like hierarchy over you, but like, you know, but I think, yeah, as you said, it's a backlash to the lie that we've been told that we can, you know, put off our fertility, you know, our expectations of growing a family, you know, for as long as possible. We can freeze our eggs and then just kind of turn it back on when we're ready, you know. So I think there's a lot of, yeah, like we've been lied to, which I totally believe. Like I totally think we've been lied to about birth control and about our fertility. And I think, you know, the sexual revolution had a lot of negative impacts on women. It wasn't all just freedom and liberation and, you know, free access to, you know, abortion pills was like our ticket out of oppression. No, like I, you know, it's so complicated, but yeah, I see it in my own particular niche flavor. Not, ooh, thankfully not as scary as the trad. I don't know about the trad wife, but yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely reclamation in, you know, being back on the land and, you know, tending to the home and having the home be, you know, the center, and not just the kind of the transitory place you go in between work every day. So I see value in the best of intentions, you know, around that, and also the misogyny and the regressive thinking in that, for sure.
It's always another question. I'm having a lot of questions today for you. It's always another question. Who benefits?
Right.
Yeah, of course, if a woman wants to bake bread, go and do it. I love bread. I would eat all of the bread. But really, who benefits if you're just staying at home watching the kids? If it's a life you like, okay. But as a class, women have been told to do this for centuries. So
Right.
maybe it shouldn't be the only option. This is where I would like the idea of choice. As a concept, we should have free choice and we can get philosophical about it if you like. But I would like the choice of earning my own money or baking my own bread. Women should be able to have the choice. And I notice the more and more I think about it, how much free choice do women really have? For example, to go on birth control, how much choice do you have? If at first you're socialized to believe that you should like men, and then they're pressuring you to have sex with them, so of course you're going to go on birth control because you don't like you're 14, 15 years old, you don't want to have a baby. So if you can access birth control, of course you're going to do it. This was my story also. And I was on birth control for almost a decade. And then my uterus sang the song of freedom, and my periods were wicked for the first for the first few months because my body had to take back control. That was a crazy, crazy a few months. But just noticing the things that happen to our bodies when we feel like we have to make a decision that's actually not a good decision in the long run for us. And this applies to almost any topic that we could talk about.
And the withholding, you know, of you know, natural fertility methods that are highly effective, you know, that that are left out of textbooks. I mean, the OBGYN doesn't know how to practice fertility awareness method, you know, to the point where it's 99.8% effective, which it can be with perfect use, you know. So it's like, then there's that. It's like, I didn't, most women say, myself included, is like, I didn't know that there was a third option, where I could actually be have control over my fertility, whether or not I want to get pregnant or not, and also just know what's going on inside of my body, you know, use that as a source of confidence, see where my hormones need a little more nourishment. But instead, it's the irresponsible. You want to get pregnant? You want to be irresponsible, or you want to listen to the doctor in the white coat and take the drugs?
Exactly. Yeah, it's this pressure of being responsible when you can't really make a choice otherwise. You can't drink, you can't force join the army, but somehow you're forced to take birth control.
Right.
I just wanted to add to what you're saying. I'm sorry that I interrupt.
No, not at all.
When you say that this kind of, what did you say? Birth control, like fertility options are not trained or not shared. There's no education about them in the actual field of fertility. There's also not so much education about the female body in general. Like the clitoris has only just been talked about. It's just been discovered, which I think is such a funny way of putting it. But really the clitoris was just, I guess, publicized and taken seriously by male scientists and male medical experts. The clitoris of all organs. Jeez. This just blows me away. It just makes me really sad. Like, I love my clitoris, and I wish women would love their clitorises too, spend more time with them. How dare they take this away from us? Especially when we talk about FGM, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The way that our bodies are so mutilated beyond recognition. It's obscene. It's a human rights violation, really. This goes for FGM, and this goes also for what we see happening in these transgender surgeries on really young girls. I mean, girls of any age, but how dare they do this to us? It makes me really mad. I'm just noticing how mad I'm getting with you.
Yeah.
It's really insane. Yeah.
It's pretty horrible. And even if just you think about the testosterone, like the enlargement. Well, actually, one of the, like, from the testosterone use, the enlarged clitoris, but also birth control actually shrinks your clitoris.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a book called The Fifth Vital Sign that's written by a woman that I know named Lisa Hendrickson Jack. And she, cites a study where they found that one of the lesser known side effects to the public, at least, is clitoral shrinkage. And actually the only male birth control that ever was produced and went through a couple trials, it didn't make it anywhere because one of the side effects was testicle shrinkage. The men were like,
that.
Oh, fuck this. Yet, you know, women are facing all sorts of long and short-term side effects with taking hormonal birth control, and that's just with the pill. I mean, we're not even talking about the IUD or the patch or the implant. You know, we're just talking about the pill, which is bad enough, but that is a whole thing. But yeah, I feel your anger, and I've also heard, you know, like you know, it kind of felt like, I don't know if you felt this way, but there seemed to be a lot of momentum, at least in my like doula world, when I was a doula and like teaching fertility awareness method and teaching reproductive health workshop, there was this reclamation of like, yeah, like our vagina actually is distinct from the vulva. Like it's, you know, we've been using the wrong words. And like, you know, why are we saying fallopian tube? Like that was just a guy named George Fallopia, like an Italian obstetrician. Like that's our uterine tube, you know, like really being more specific about the language that we use. And then bam, men can give birth.
Mm-mm-mm.
Men can have periods, men can have abortions. Like it's just a hole, it's just a front hole.
It's insane. This reframing of things is infuriating. I was just thinking about this, as I mentioned FGM, I also thought about how many people compare it to male circumcision. It's not the same thing. And they try to call FGM female circumcision. It's not the same thing. When we call the vaginal hole the front hole, that's not it. My urethra is my front hole. I have three holes, and I don't want to even call them holes. That's demeaning. And I find that language is the battlefield on which this ideological fight is happening. But in the real world, the language is having real life physical effects on our bodies through all of the institutions that are pushing this ideological linguistic manipulation into our minds. It's like, first we have to take the pill, which is the language. And then the pill affects our body, which is the different kinds of things that we either opt to or are forced to undergo. I really think that we need to take back the language in every way that we can. And I find it really great that the fallopian tubes were not called fallopian, the uterine tubes. Yeah. When I found out that almost every part of the female reproductive system is named after one man or another, that was a bad day. So thank you for making that effort about the tubes. My tubes appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so glad. One of my favorites that I learned from a traditional Chinese medicine doctor that I interviewed named Susie Hazen. She said that the meaning or the word for uterus in according to their textbooks, I can't remember if it's Mandarin, I can't remember, but the translation for the word that they use to describe the uterus is palace of the child.
Isn't
that amazing? The palace of the child.
I mean, that's beautiful and amazing. But my warning sign is, it's like, not every woman should or has to or must have babies.
No.
But it's interesting. It signifies, I think, the kind of biological imperative that's placed upon women in order to reproduce, to give the next generation of progeny, of soldiers to defend the land, of patriarchs. But still, it's a very nice sounding.
I love your interpretation. You know, it resonated with me because it took it out of the pathology, like of the cells and the tissue and even the blood. You know, the blood is amazing, but like it just took it out of, it really took it into like a spiritual kind of realm, you know, rather than just a function, you know, of the body and its potential to create life. And that, you know, it just metaphorically, just your body or your matricentric like look on the world being like, how can we create like a palace for children? Like, how can this universe be like a safe place for the child, you know, whether you're actually bearing children or not? And that comes up, that came up a lot in the course with Haida too, you know, talking about the aunties and the role of the women who don't, you know, who don't give birth, and the role of how to mother without, you know, actually technically being a mother. Now I feel like we can't really talk about that because then it gets into like the third party euphemistic kind of language, third party reproduction euphemistic language, where you're like, no, you're not actually a mom. Like, you bought that woman and like you rented her and then bought her baby. So don't you dare call yourself a mother, you know. But in the context of matriarch societies, the mother and creating that environment is beyond the actual bearing of the child. There's a societal responsibility to the children of the earth, which is the lens through which I think, you know, not the only lens I think women are coming into this work, right? We want to defend adult human females, but, you know, we are also looking at the children who are being gaslit to no end. And God, they're little spongy minds. I digress.
Well, you bring up children. It's a good topic to talk about. And there's, on one side, you have the matriarchal idea that the village raises the child. I love that idea, especially when everyone involved is responsible and, for the better part, mature and dependable adults or young children. Everyone cares about each other, and there's not a threat of the kind of abuse that is lurking around today in the isolated homes. No, if you commit violence, you're isolated. It's interesting that that is the punishment where most people are isolated today in a normal life. Yeah. But on one hand, you have this idea, it's beautiful, where the child is loved, or at least taken care of and watched over by everybody. And on the other hand, you have this idea of this, the third party concept, where one woman donates her egg, a second woman gestates that egg through pregnancy and gives birth to the resulting child. And then a third woman is the legal mother. So one child could have three mothers through the system of in vitro fertilization and surrogacy. What is that child going to do when they grow up and learn that they have actually three mothers? One that they're emotionally connected to, and two that they're genetically related to. It's also a question of, yeah, gaslighting. How is a child going to process this? What structures are in place to support children who are in this position? I think there was an article published in recently about exactly this situation, where a young girl has grown into adolescence and she's realized that she has three moms. How is she going to process that? I also think of the children, to change the topic a little bit, I also think of the children who have been, I don't want to say breastfed, but chest fed by their fathers, who are taking these, yeah, I don't even want to talk about it, but it needs to be talked about. The fathers are taking cross-sex hormones in order to force lactation, and then they're forced chest feeding their newborn infants. Meanwhile, the actual birth mother is lactating in a chair. Like, what structures are in place to support these children? That's what I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the mothers. I mean, we also have the topic of the mothers who are forced to endure this kind of gaslighting, is a good word for it. There's also trans widows. So women who have been married to men and then the men transition. I think Vaishnavi Sundar is publishing a film very soon on this topic, featuring interviews of exactly these women. I'm excited about this film. I don't know if it's out yet,
mm-hmm.
but when it comes out, yeah.
I saw that. I've interviewed at least two. One of them became he was a sissy hypnoporn addict and ran through lots of money, was physically abusive. Yeah, demanded the kids call him mom. I mean, just the typical rigmarole of a narcissistic, trans-identified porn addict man. Just the butchering of the what it means to be, just linguistically, Mary Lou always talks about this. Like, they've taken everything. Like, I will not, she's like, you know, to even give it over linguistically to say that men can give birth, even if you don't believe it, just to give it over linguistically is such a betrayal. You know, to say that men can be moms and breastfeed, and yeah, what you're describing about the breastfeeding is totally perverse. And it's not, I mean, someone who has no idea of like lactation and the number of ounces a baby would need throughout the day will see that like cover image, you know, on an article and go, wow, he's breastfeeding. She's breastfeeding that baby, when in reality, like at best, he might be producing like drops, like a fraction of what the baby actually needs, which makes it even more perverse. Like, why? Who is this for? It's for
exactly.
You.
Exactly.
It's for you.
Who is this for?
And Jennifer Law talks about that with the buyers of the babies, who, you know, the heterosexual couples, the same sex couples, who will do that skin to skin with the baby that they bought. It does absolutely nothing. The purpose of skin to skin is for like the baby to find the breast and for the mother to release enough oxytocin for her uterus to contract so that she doesn't hemorrhage. Like it has a function, right? It's a very like complex and beautiful and yet very simple as well process if it's uninterrupted. And so you have this baby rustling around, rooting, trying to find the breast on a man they never met, who's might not even, they're like, might not even be biologically related. It is so fucking creepy.
You put it this way. It's a man they never met. Exactly. It's a man they never met. It's a stranger, basically. Oh my God. Something clicked when you said this.
And I have really firm lines around like even dad doing, like the actual dad, you know, not in a surrogate situation. It's like the baby, unless the mom and baby are separated for some, you know, reason, you know, she's had a surgery or God forbid she's, you know, not conscious or whatever.
Mm.
But I mean, that baby is a newborn. That baby needs to be on its mother like immediately to ensure like its well-being and the mother's. They're one. They're still one.
Yeah.
They're still one. It's just, yeah, it's.
I wonder where we're going to go next. I mean, in the beginning, I was talking about all my peak moments, right? The next crazy thing and the next crazy thing. And every time I peak, it feels like this is it. And then we hear about these men forcing lactation. And then what's going to happen next? What's the next crazy thing that we're going to hear? I'm kind of jaded from it all. I know that I should expect something ridiculous to happen. I also have a small lingering hope that it's going to turn around, you know, and we have seen the first moments of this, I think, coming from the UK, where this Tavistock clinic is shut down. I mean, Keira Bell winning her case was amazing. Also with Alison Bailey going in there and the Women of LGB Alliance too, women going into the court system and fighting, I don't want to say fighting the good fight, but that's really what they did. They're standing up for lesbians and they're standing up for women. This was really nice to see. So I hope we see more of these stories as time progresses, not just the crazy shit, but the amazing successes that women are achieving.
Yeah, I hope so too. And here we had Jamie Reed, the St. Louis, Missouri clinic whistleblower. That was pretty big.
Oh, I'll look into this.
Hear about that? She was working at a gender clinic, being like, I don't really think like this child is like stable like to do this. And in many words, that's my brief summary. But yeah, she has like records of emails that she had, you know, sent saying like, I don't think we should be doing this, or like, I have concerns. And yeah. And there's been also some glimmers of hope from the New York Times. They were under fire for their.
About J.K. Rowling, this thing. What is it?
I think it was a series. I don't know if it was specific to J.K. It might have been. I think it was just like a kind of a trend of veering away from the pro-trans affirmation narrative. And for that, GLAAD did a truck outside. And then Amanda Stuhlman, who runs the USA Keep Prison Single Sex, did her own LED billboard truck outside the New York Times in response. So there is, yeah, I hear your hope. I mean, maybe. I mean, but I also think it gets freakier and freakier, you know, because the technology is getting more advanced.
Yes.
And it's like, are you really going to do that? And they're like, yeah, we're really going to do that.
Sometimes I don't want to think about it. You know, we see these sci-fi movies and men can do whatever they want in movies or in literature. Male perversion knows no bounds in the fantasy world. I'm just hoping that the boundary between fantasy and reality is not so blurred in the next days, years, whatever. But I think it really does help, though, when women get out and onto the street and do things. Like you're saying, this woman got her own truck and put it outside as a her own protest. I think this kind of stuff really, really helps. And it can be small things too. I mean, you don't have to get a truck and put it on the street. You can also just talk to your friends and family.
Yeah.
Or you can do what I did in the very beginning, get a really big Sharpie and go out at 3 a.m. You don't have to put your face, you know, out there if you don't feel like it's a comfortable thing to do. But as long as we don't give up, then there will be hope. And we need to have hope to keep going.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or family member who needs to hear this content. And if you do share it on social media, don't forget to follow and tag me at Whose Body Is It? So until next time.